The heat was so great and the air so impure, he started to spit up blood. You know where he's at, don't you? He's down there now underneath. Still, he would not give up. At the end of another 50 feet, he made a discovery which seemed to indicate he might be on the right track. On the west side of the passage, he found a low doorway leading into a hole. As the Arabs began to dig upward into this hole, Caviglia noted a strong smell of sulfur. It occurred to him he might have hit upon the solution to his previous problem. The smell of sulfur might be coming from the bottom of the well where he had dropped it earlier. Got that? Which means it must be close. Digging harder, the Arab workmen dislodged some loose earth. A pile of dust and rubbish fell onto them, including a basket and ropes which had been left at the bottom of the well. There was also a sudden gush of air up the tunnel, and those in the passage were able to breathe with ease. Caviglia had discovered the end of the well, but a greater mystery remained. Why had it been dug there? When? By whom? I mean, they didn't make it to the lower passage, which would have taken them out past the plugs. Why that well? Now, there are students of theology in England that figured it out. As Caviglia set about resolving his mystery, another strange figure joined the research. Richard Howard Vise, or Vice, whatever it is, B-Y-S-E, a British Guards officer. Grandson of the Earl of Stafford. You people carried away with all the marriages and things, trace all these things back. He saw the pyramids on a moonlit ride from across the Nile in November 1836. He became fascinated. They decided they'd dig around Davison's chamber again. The colonel had relays of men work day and night digging up the floor in front of the niche. Now, the poor old Italian had turned it into an apartment. Now they're going to ruin it. But all they found was an old basket, so they refilled the hole. In Davison's chamber, they found a crack in the ceiling through which they could run a reed about 3 feet long. Believing this to be an indication of a similar chamber above, the colonel had the workmen chisel their way into the granite over their heads. But the stone was too hard, and again the Arabs couldn't stand the heat and the restricted space of Davison's low ceiling chamber. Special quarrymen were imported from the hills across the valley. When even they couldn't manage the job, the colonel resorted to gunpowder to blast his way upward. To handle the charges, he found a workman called Dowd who lived mostly on hash and alcohol. Dowd successfully set off the blast. I mean, there were guys getting high in those days and doing foolish things too. A job that was particularly dangerous as the splintered gravel flew about like shrapnel as he puffed away on his hash. When the dust subsided, the colonel found they'd indeed broken through to another chamber, which he chauvinistically named after Wellington. Its floor was the top of the 8 monolithic blocks of granite. Remember, each one of them was the size of a locomotive, which formed the rough-hewn ceiling of Davison's chamber, each block weighing over 50 tons. About a yard above them lay another flat ceiling made of 8 blocks of granite, so he had another chamber now. The new chamber had a strange effect on those who entered. It turned them black. I'm going to quit right there. It turned them black. Instead of bat dung, the floor was covered with a thin black powder. Sorry, I'm going to ruin it. I'm going to ruin it. That is not the origin of the black race. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Good enough for them, though. In that place, they got all turned black. Instead of bat dung, the floor was covered with a thin black powder, which, when analyzed, turned out to be the cast-off shells and skins of insects. Of living insects, there were none to be found. All dead. Convinced that the monoliths of the ceiling were in turn the floor of the third chamber, the colonel ordered the blasting resumed. So out comes the hash and the alcohol. The colonel's excavations above the king's chamber became more and more difficult as they rose vertically to a height of 40 feet. Let me show you. He uncovered not one, not two, but this is the way it looked when he got done. See how many chambers? Davison's the first one, then the second one, then the third one, then the fourth one, then a big one up here. Way up there. Now let me skip along, because let me go to an even higher one. Further discoveries continue to uncover as you move right on up. Just right on up. No treasures in any of them. No money. Look how barren. Empty tomb. The most interesting discovery was not so much the chambers themselves, but some red paint markings daubed on the inner walls of the upper chambers. Thanks to the Rosetta Stone, which was as significant in decoding the hieroglyphics of these areas as the alphabet that has been discovered, Linear B, in other areas, this enabled them to decipher the hieroglyphics. The Rosetta Stone, thanks to it, not found here, they were able to decipher these hieroglyphics. One of them was recognized by Egyptologists as belonging to Khufu, believed to be the second pharaoh of the fourth dynasty called Cheops by the Greeks, whose reign was, mark this, thought to have occurred in the third millennium before our era. That's 3,000 years back. There is, of course, no way to prove that this Khufu, whomever he was indeed the Cheops. I mean, it could have been Enoch. Could have been some unknown superhuman helped person prior to the flood. Could have been Ham. Could have been Noah. Noah lived a long time after the flood. Could have been any one of these people. My mother's already choosing up sides over there. She's already choosing up sides. Could have been Noah. Could have been Ham. Don't jump too quick, anybody. Even my mama, don't you jump too quick. Could have been Noah. Could have been Ham. Could have been Enoch. Could have been Cheops. Could have been anybody. I'm having so much fun. I didn't build it. Really. I've just been here a little while. One thing seemed clear. Whoever daubed these things on the inner walls of the upper chambers must have done so before the chamber was sealed, or else somebody got in there. And somebody might have got in there and tripped the mechanisms that let the plugs loose. Or maybe the fail-safe guy plugged it. Another remarkable discovery made by the colonel in the walls of the king's chamber was to vindicate a former hypothesis of one Dr. Harvey. Greaves had found the 2 9-inch wide openings in the side walls of the king's chamber, but it was not until Mr. Hill, one of the colonel's assistants, who ran a hotel in Cairo, climbed high up on the outer surface of the pyramid and found two similar outlets way up there, that it was established they were connected for over 200 feet right through solid masonry to the holes in the king's chamber. The colonel's engineer Paring was nearly decapitated when a stone dislodged the hill, came crashing all the way down one of these conduits and zipped out through the hole in the king's chamber and hit him in the head. Somebody behind me said, "Oh, God." From bats to falling rocks 200 feet down a whistling hole. When the conduit was cleared, an immediate rush of cool air entered the king's chamber. Remember, for centuries, one opening was lost. Only found when these people bored in happened to hit it. Now they find these two little holes because they had found inside a hole. And when they fiddle around with it, a rock comes down through it, nearly decapitates the engineer. And when it was cleared, an immediate rush of cool air entered the king's chamber. Thus ventilated, the temperature of this chamber in the center of the pyramid was to remain at an even and pleasant 68 degrees, irrespective of the weather or season outside. Never changing from 68 degrees. A prehistoric system of air conditioning. I mean, maybe, Mom, a fellow that learned to live in a boat with as many stinking animals as Noah did developed a premium on air conditioning. My mother's already voted, though. She says, "It ain't Noah." This added substance to the theory that the chamber might have been the repository for weights and measures which require an even temperature and constant barometric pressure. Now, we run around with our little amateur measuring devices, but if you really want to measure, you got to have an even temperature. Anybody knows that a measuring instrument changes in size with temperature? Such as the Paris Observatory for Measurement of Standards, which is 85 feet below ground. Hey, these are centuries old. Even more sensational for those who are bent on unraveling the secrets of the pyramid was the next discovery of the colonel. How many quit? 4-1. Huh? What? Finish the book? No, when I get over here, I'm going to just talk. This little narrative portion is so interesting, the rest of it gets pretty technical. It's interesting. Ever since the Middle Ages, when the Arabs had despoiled the outer casing, the whole perimeter of the base of the pyramid had been heaped high with fragments of limestone, often piled high as 50 feet. People argued that it didn't have that covering. This time, the colonel decided to clear away a patch of debris in the center of the north facade to see if he could get down to the very base and bedrock of the pyramid, which began a whole new study of the pyramid, by the way. In doing so, he was to make a great discovery. Two of the originally polished limestone. It's like now that the Jews, since the Six-Day War, got all of Jerusalem, the importance of them honoring the command of God that when they go to that temple and pray, he will answer them. The Wailing Wall, dug down, finally has gotten them down to the large stones of the old Solomon temple. Likewise, the digging got them down to where he made the great discovery. Two of the original polished limestone casing stones on the lowest level of the pyramid were still in the spot where they'd been originally placed. Now, this is critical for the measurements. They had to have the perfect limestone smooth coverings to start getting at the perfection of the measurements of this pyramid. This ended the argument about the casing. It silenced forever those who continued to consider it a fiction that the whole of the pyramid had once been covered with a fine mantle of limestone. Do you know that Abraham, in his old age, as I said earlier, could go to that place where he built the altar and climb Mount Gerizim and see that pyramid reflected in the sun and take a sighting? You know, when the ships left Knossos in Crete, that I'll argue with even my mother, Noah built. He could take his sightings on that pyramid. The original limestone was there, and so finely carved that it was now possible to correctly measure the angle of the slope on which the pyramid had been originally constructed. The blocks 5 feet high, 12 feet long, and 8 feet wide showed an angle of about 51 degrees, 51 minutes, a little sharper than the one estimated by the French. Hewn to the correct angle and polished to a uniform surface, these were quite perfect. In a sloping plane as correct and true as modern work by optical instrument makers, the joints were scarcely perceptible, not wider than the thickness of silver paper. Any builders know what I'm saying? The colonel also managed to uncover part of the original pavement on which the building rested, and which appeared to stretch away to the north. Now, I'm going to skip along. They took some of those stones from the Nile cataracts. They built perfectly level, not level in terms of the degree or angle, but the road itself level, perfectly level granite block roads. There are hieroglyphics showing the throwing of oil on the roads to make it slick, and workmen, men, pushing in uniform form, dragging these blocks on those roads constructed to get the blocks to where the pyramid was built. A poet and essayist who had never set eyes on the pyramid was to take the measurements of the colonel and others, Greaves and the scientists that had been there, and draw from Napoleon's intellectual brain trust, and draw from them a set of conclusions, the most far-reaching thus far about the origin and purpose of the pyramid. John Taylor, the son of a London bookseller, whose regular job was editing the London Observer, already was in his 50s when the colonel returned from Egypt. He was to spend the next 30 years until he was 80 collecting and comparing accounts from those who had visited the pyramid. A gifted mathematician and amateur astronomer, Taylor made models to scale of the pyramid and began to analyze the results from a mathematician's point of view. This comes out of the age when it's supposed to be cavemen. To account for the discrepancies in the length of the base reported by successive travelers, it occurred to Taylor that each measure had arrived on the scene, that as each measure had arrived, more sand and rubble had been cleared from the base, and in essence they measured from a different spot. But that suddenly solved with the colonel, who digs down and finds the platform on which it was built and the roads leading away from it. Wasn't any desert when it was built, by the way, as now. Sand wasn't blowing like it is now. Taylor was puzzled as to why the builders of the pyramid should have chosen the particular angle of 51 degrees, 51 minutes for the pyramid spaces instead of the regular equilateral triangle of 60 degrees. I mean, why these old dummies back there in the cave age pick that? Analyzing Herodotus, that ancient Greek historian's report of what the Egyptian priests had told him about the surface of each face of the pyramid, Taylor concluded they had been designed to be equal in area to the square of the pyramid's height. If so, this meant the building was of a particular, if not unique, geometric construction, and no other pyramid ever discovered had these proportions. Taylor then discovered that if he divided the perimeter of the pyramid by twice its height, it gave him a quotient of 3.144. Remarkably close to the value of pi, which is computed as 3.14159 plus. You geometry students will catch that. In other words, the height of the pyramid appeared to be in relation to the perimeter of its base as the radius of a circle is to its circumference. This seemed to Taylor far too extraordinary to attribute to chance. And he deduced that the pyramid might have been specifically intended by its builders to incorporate the incommensurable value of pi. If so, this was a demonstration of the advanced knowledge of the builders. Footnote. Not till the 6th century was pi correctly worked out to the fourth decimal point by the Hindu sage Aryabhatta. It took another 1,000 years from the 6th century, 1600, before the Dutchman Pierre Metius calculated pi to the 6th decimals by means of the fraction 355/113. In 1593, Francois Viète carried the computation to 11 figures, and a generation later, Rudolf van Suylen, just before he died, took pi to 127 figures. In 1813, the English mathematician William Shanks developed pi to 707 decimals, and modern computers have carried the operation to 10,000 points of decimal, but with no solution to this apparently incommensurable number. Nobody knows why that pi divided by diameter produces the circumference of the circle, but it does. But these guys, way back there, without all those computers, I mean, if my mother's right and it wasn't Noah, it was Noah, somebody heaps smart like him. They had all those years to live to compound knowledge. Still today, the oldest known document, which indicates that the Egyptians had knowledge of the value of pi, is the Rhine Papyrus, dated about 1700 B.C. Therefore, much later than the pyramid. Found in the wrappings of a mummy in 1855 by a young Scottish archaeologist, Henry Alexander Rhine, the rare papyrus is now in the British Museum. It has a very rough value of pi of 3.166. Or 1/6, rough value. Well, what did he find out? He found out if he divided the perimeter of the pyramid by twice its height, which would be the diameter if it were twice, if it were the top half of a circle, namely a reproduction of the northern hemisphere, if it were to be the whole globe, and he takes the pyramid as it now exists, having gained the mathematical ability to measure it properly, and if he divided the perimeter of the pyramid but twice its height, it gave him a quotient of 3.144, remarkably close to the value of pi, which is 3.141. It took until the 6th century to work it out to four decimals. Now, I'm going to anticipate and tell you. They keep measuring. Then they uncover the mystery. I'm going to lose my glasses and have to quit, but I'm lucky I got an extra pair tonight. They then discovered that phenomenon of the royal cube, cubic foot, cubic measurement. Got so many glasses tonight, I made up my mind, nothing is going to stop me. That was made for a big head. They discovered that it was the royal cubit of measurement rather than the average one. They then discovered when the airplane was invented and a colonel at a certain time of the day flying by accident took a picture that revealed a curved inward shape to the pyramid, which accounted for some of the linear measurements. And when they corrected all of their measurements properly, with the continuing scientific measuring devices and the recognition of the royal cubit element of measurement rather than the average, and the concave nature of the base, and corrected all their measurements, it came out exactly pi. Exactly what the computer now finds. Taylor discovered in his little computation that was remarkably close. 3.144. Now, pi, you that study geometry, you know what pi is. It's the little symbol of the P in the Greek language. You take a circle, find the diameter, multiply it by pi, 3 point to those figures, and you end up with a circumference of the circle. Now, they had designed this pyramid to anticipate where I'm going on the royal cubic measurements in such a manner that when they finally deciphered what the units of measurement were in this pyramid, it was on an exact scale when multiplied that the best computers in the land today cannot improve upon the circumference, including the offness of this oval-shaped globe that modern computers can find for the shape and circumference of the earth. Perfect. Now, Mama dear, Noah floated around the whole blame thing. He knew it was round because he went round, round it. I love my mother. I'm not saying it's Noah, Mom. I'm just saying, boy, that imitator, if he did it, is a good one. Oh, these glasses are going to kill me. Searching for the reason for such a pie proportion in the pyramid, Taylor concluded that the perimeter might have been intended to represent the circumference. Listen, Taylor concluded that the perimeter might have been intended to represent the Taylor concluded that the perimeter might have been intended to represent the circumference of the earth at the equator, while the height represented the distance from the earth's center to the pole. Can't see it over this one. Perhaps the ancient designers had measured the length of a geographical degree, multiplied it by 360 for the circumference of the globe, and by the pi relation had deduced the polar radius of the earth, immortalizing their knowledge by making the circumference to scale with the perimeter and the radius to scale with the height of the pyramid. Now, I'm going to anticipate you more. I'm going to tell you. Well, let me go on. Taylor underlined his thesis. It was to make a record of the measure of the earth that it was built. He then elaborated. They knew the earth was a sphere, and by observing the motion of the heavenly bodies over the earth's surface, had ascertained its circumference, and were desirous of leaving behind them a record of the circumference as correct and imperishable as it was possible for them to construct. Now let's assume it's a time capsule. Old Enoch, who walked with God, knew everybody's going to be wiped out. He's preserving knowledge that had accumulated during those days before the flood. Now, if you or anybody out there says that I've taken a stand, I'm going to come through this TV screen at you and bring some bats with me. I'm just reporting. Just reporting. But it was evident to Taylor that the builders of the pyramid could not have used for their calculations such a unit as the British foot.